So welcome to your last class, and I'm going to be looking further at women's rights. I was just playing you a little song there, a very powerful song from the 1960s by Peggy Seeger, I Wanna Be an Engineer, which is kind of humorous, but it's about all the difficult things she had to do to get to be an engineer. And it's true that although it was possible for women to enter many jobs, let's move over to Britain, it was possible for women to enter many jobs after the 60s, it was for a long time tremendously difficult, because if you did want to be an engineer in the 60s as a woman, then you were going to spend your entire life as the woman engineer surrounded by 30 men engineers, who, some of whom would be very nice, but you would nevertheless be very isolated. And it's only really all 30 years later that it began to be that you weren't going to be the only one around, which is something worth taking into account. Okay, so first of all, just a little bit of administration. The people have begun to send in their homeworks. When I said midnight, 9 o'clock the next morning is okay. I'm not really sitting in front of my computer at midnight waiting for your homework. If you have questions which are not answered on the blog, just put them into the chat and I will answer them. Otherwise, what I would like to do today is talk a little bit more about the history of women's rights, and I'm going to follow this journalistic idea of the three waves of women's rights struggles. Of course, it's an oversimplification. It's not true that nothing happened between them. On the other hand, it is true that social movements do tend to come in waves. I'm thinking about the campaign for nuclear disarmament in Britain. It had a huge wave from 1958 to 63, and then another huge wave from 1978 to 83. And it can sometimes be difficult to know exactly why the wave came along. It has a certain internal dynamic. In any case, let me get to your slide show. Yes, okay. There you go. No, we've got one more person coming in there, and I just need to choose Diopohama, Liha Partie de la Dispositive Actuelle, and go back up there. Okay, so yes, so I'm going to look today then at what is often called the second wave of the struggle for women's liberation, then from the late 60s until probably 1979 and the election of Margaret Thatcher, not as part of the women's liberation issue, as I shall show. So first of all, just a couple of dates. 1968 is a kind of interesting date because the Church of Scotland becomes the first church in the United Kingdom to authorise the ordination of women ministers. So before the Church of England, and again, this is of tremendous symbolic importance, because the role of religious minister is probably in historically even more masculine than the role of soldier or something, or the role of astronaut. Religious rules are obviously very firmly laid down and very traditional, and so it was quite an important moment symbolically, even for people who are not religious. Now, the second wave of women's liberation struggle was extremely varied. There were many different initiatives, there were many different ideas, and I think it's quite important not to imagine some sort of homogeneity or to think that it was monolithic. Just like the suffragettes were deeply divided, first of all, between the direct action current and the constitutionalist current at the very beginning of the 20th century, and secondly, once the First World War came out, between the anti-war feminist, the minority, and the pro-war feminist, the majority. So similarly, in the 1970s, it's very varied. But here we have a poster which represents a certain section of the idea, and it's you can see that it's what we would call a consciousness-raising poster, really, and you can see what it says: sisters, question every aspect of our lives. So it's something. There's something very new about this, that it's not just saying we want the right to vote, we want the right to become doctors. It's a much wider idea, and it comes from the idea that women, because they generally, unlike other groups, live with members of the non-target group concerning sexism, then sexism has integrated every everyday life in a much stronger way. So, for example, obviously, if one is black, one suffers from racism, but one is not obliged to. Most black people don't have to live in a family with a white person. They can choose to, whereas this is obviously something rather specific about women, that they typically live with a man or a man. And so here this poster shows some of the aspects of everyday oppression, and this comes along with the slogan, if you like, "The personal is political," which really, at the origin, as I understand it, meant the personal also is political. And so here you can see the question of sexual harassment, the questions of being obliged to put on makeup, the question of housework, the question of when you write a form, having to say you are Mrs. or you are Miss. Are you married or not? And then another couple of questions at the bottom, which I'll understand better. The advertising which presents women as servants of men, and in the final picture there, this idea of judging each other, women judging each other by their appearance. So this is the idea that if you want women's liberation, it's not enough to say we need to change this law, we need to change that law. Every aspect of everyday life will need to be changed, and some of them have. At the same time as this diffuse campaign for consciousness raising, and I think probably at its height in the 70s there were a few hundred women's groups around the country, independent, not opposed to political parties, but independent of political parties, and dealing with all these different kinds of issues. At the same time, there was important moments within the workplace. And here is one of them. In 1968, the women at the Ford car factory in Dagenham, who had specific jobs, if I remember correctly, they were making and installing the fabrics for the inside the car, and it was only women doing that. They discovered that they understood how much skill you needed to make fabrics and put them where they go in the car, and they discovered that men doing jobs which require a similar skill level were being paid much more, and so they went on strike, and they got some support from men. It was rather controversial, and they had a very effective strike, because cars without fabrics cannot be sold, even though the car is worth much more than the fabric. You can't replace. And one of the results of this strike slowly was the passing of the Equal Pay Act in 1970. And here you have then series of dates in the 1970s which are important, although, as I was saying, laws are not the whole story by a long way. So 1970 Equal Pay Act, that means, remember what it actually means, it means that before 1970, any employer could say, I need somebody to do this job. If they're a man, I will pay them £800. If they're a woman, I will pay them £600. And that was completely legal and normal. And so after 1970, they couldn't do that. Now, many employers tried to find ways around it. They would define the job differently if it was women doing it and so on. But nevertheless, it was a great step forward that it should be illegal. 1975, then, Sex Discrimination Act. This was about being able to hire somebody. If a woman turned up and said, I want to be a bus driver. I can drive a bus. I want to do that. After 1975, it was illegal to say, oh, no, sorry, we want a man for driving a bus, we want a man. And so this gave a lot more choice
slowly gave a lot more choice to women in the workplace, mostly for fairly ordinary jobs. You know, I mean, mostly it's not a question of becoming general manager of ICI or at the head of the MI5. Quite often, when you see stories about women's progress, they only talk about people at the top. But in fact, you know, if lorry driver is what you want to do and you can't do it because you're a woman, or if football is what you want to play and you can't do it because it's a woman, of course, those are tremendously important questions. 1976 Domestic Violence Act, then that gave the beginnings of the possibility for the police to intervene in case of violent husbands, whereas previously the semi-official position was, oh, it's a family question, we don't get involved. And in 1976, the establishment, as I understand it, mostly by voluntary organisations, but with some public money, of rape crisis centres, which were places which women could go to be if they'd been raped or if they were in danger of rape. Now, this whole movement, if you like, we talk about the women's movement in the 1970s, and I'm quite happy with the word movement for the 1970s, because when you have many thousands of people doing things, I call that a movement. I must say that in other periods, people continue to talk about the women's movement when it's much, much, much smaller. And I prefer in these periods to talk about women's liberation networks or feminist networks, because that's what I call it when you have a few hundred people doing something. And this included important publications. The whole change in activity and organisation and consciousness included a series of important publications. This is Germaine Greer. I think she is Australian, at least she lives in Australia now. And she published this book in 1970, The Female Eunuch, which presented the position of women within marriage as extremely negative, and said that in fact it was taking away their sexuality and so on and so forth. Worth a read as a it's worth a read despite Germaine Greer's later, in my opinion, rather conservative political opinions. So a couple of dates here. Over 4,000 women then in 1971 take first in the first Women's Liberation March. Notice that the word feminist does not occur. Some would call themselves feminists, some not. 1972, the first women's refuge. A women's refuge is somewhere where a wife who is in a violent marriage can leave and go with her children to live for a couple of months until they find a solution. Yeah, this is the women's refuge. And I would like to know how that works today. I don't know. And finally, then in 1974, a national organisation, the National Women's Aid Federation, getting the idea that this was a normal national thing to have, and so little by little, more and more women knew that if they knew somebody who was in a dreadful situation like that, there was somewhere to go. Now, as you can imagine, these places never had enough funding or enough space, but it was a tremendous step forward that they should just exist. One of the very important aspects of the 1970s and women's liberation is the magazine Spare Rib. If you're going to have a movement that lasts any period of time, you must have a publication. Movements which don't have a publication don't last long. Now, that may not be completely true today in the world of the internet, but before the internet, if you didn't have a regular publication, you were going to disappear as a movement. And Spare Rib was established then in June 1972, although this is an example from 1978. And it was very different from previous publications about women's liberation, because previous regular publications were newsletters. They were typed, gestetnet, ask your grandparents. You make many copies by going like this, then you staple them, then you fold them up, you put them in an envelope, and you write the address of your 50 or 100 or 200 subscribers, and you send them by post to everybody. It's a lot of work. Yeah, those old activists are tired for a reason. This was completely different. You could buy it in the newsagents. It had professional production. You can see the production values there for the time were completely acceptable. You get pictures, big pictures, headlines, chirpy writing, and so on. So it became a in style, it was mainstream, which meant it got out to far more people, and was produced regularly from June 1972 for, oh, at least 20 years, I say. Now, it's a rather unusual magazine because quite recently the British Library, the National Library of Britain, decided that they were going to put online all the archives of this magazine. And you can go to the British Library Spare Rib and you can browse through all the every issue, every page of every issue. Now, that's very interesting. First of all, obviously, it's very good news for historians like myself because you can find out the actual detail. But also, it's quite interesting because some people have suggested that it is because it's not such a radical magazine. If the National Library is happy to put it on their front page with all the archives, maybe it was not so far from the mainstream. That's a debate. Now, you can see this particular one with George Best on sex. Georgie Best on sex, I don't know who that is. It's not the footballer. Does the government care about pensioners? And so on and so forth. Very, very interesting magazine. It's well worth a look. And there is another example, a slightly later one. Now this refers on the front page to a rather interesting phenomenon. Remember, I mentioned to you that the 1970s women liberation activities were very varied. So people were publishing a magazine, yeah. People were having a march. People were supporting the strikers at Grunwich. And this is a particular example: Reclaiming the Night. You can see they're Reclaiming the Night. So what was Reclaim the Night? Well, a women's liberation initiative that said, you know, one of the hard things about being a woman is that it can be dangerous. You don't feel safe if you're walking around town when it's dark. And so a series of campaigns were established to improve this situation. For example, campaigning for better lighting in public places. And one of the aspects of this campaign is that they would have at midnight marches in town, well, once a year perhaps, only open to women, torchlight processions, reclaim the night, to demonstrate, say, we have the right to be outside at night. Yeah, we have the right. We shouldn't be excluded. So a rather interesting campaign because they're not asking the government to change the law. They might be asking local governments to improve the lighting. But they're mainly asking for a more social change to think about how it is possible to make streets safe for women. Now, changes in women's rights were happening all over society. And here's an elite example. In October 1972, three Cambridge colleges admit women. There were about 30 colleges, and I think three of them were only for women. And 27 only for men, approximately. And in the 1970s, they began to allow women students to attend. So you can see that despite the fact that very often when we stereotype sexists, men, we often see the stereotypes as coming from the lower class. In fact, the elites were extremely slow to change things. In 1972, this book made a big difference, despite its title, which doesn't sound very, very exciting, Maternal Deprivation Reassessed. But this was a very important blow among, and you can see it's a popular book, it's a Penguin edition, so quite a lot of people read it. I mean, many thousands of people read it. And this attacked the official or semi-official idea that it's a terrible thing if women go to work and do not stay at home to look after their children. Now, certainly in the 60s, and I remember this, that it was generally considered, you know, if a woman just took, say, 6 months to look after her baby and then went back to work, let alone just 2 months, but if the mother went back to work when she still had a baby, there were a very large number of people who were, oh, really, oh, that's terrible. Of course, people's attitude was very often, oh, well, if they have no money at all, I understand that she has to, but isn't that a terrible situation, yeah? And this was the idea, and this idea, this so conservative or even reactionary idea, was very common and also was backed up by a large number of psychologists who talked about maternal deprivation. That is to say that if young children do not have a lot of time with their mothers, then we're going to have all sorts of problems with violent children, with delinquents and so on. And this was very, very widely believed. And Michael Rutter in 1972 published this thing and looked again at all the studies that had been done and concluded that it was a load of nonsense, that indeed it was true that babies needed adults available to care for them, but whether it was their mother or their father or a third adult was not was not a key issue. So a very important scientific advance. Again, in the elite, in the London Stock Exchange, where people sell things at high speeds with many hand gestures, women were first allowed in 1973. So you can see gradual progress in different at different levels of society. And the first woman to be elected the leader of a major political party was Margaret Thatcher in 1975. Although, as we shall see, her legacy will be extremely controversial. First of all, because when she becomes Prime Minister in 1979, she chooses ministers who are all men. Nobody had done this for many, many years. It was traditional to have a few women, and Margaret Thatcher. So Margaret Thatcher was often considered by the women's movement at the time as more of a traitor, and certainly not as a role model. More of a role model was the first regular BBC newsreader who was a woman, Angela Rippon, in 1975. Tremendously important change, because the newsreader on the television is the person who tells us how to understand the most important events in our world. It's a very, very authoritative voice. If this person, from when you're very, very little, the only people you ever see explaining the world are men, obviously that will have a big difference on how we all consider the potentialities of women. On the political organisation side, the 1970s saw Britain's first ever National Women's Liberation Conference. Now this was organised with quite a lot of support from different trade unions and some left-wing political parties, but it was independent, it was autonomous. If I remember correctly, at the first conference, there were some men involved, mostly looking after the children, which is good. So that was the first one, and there were several during the 1970s. And the last one was in 1978, and there was never another one. So the fact of having a National Women's Liberation Conference is a tremendous sign of strength, of the ideas that things must change. But obviously, having a few and then never having one again after 1978, because it was so divided, is obviously a failure. Now, within the very varied... the women's movement was really... a moment when hundreds of questions were asked. Is this normal? Is this all right? Should we accept this? Should we demand this? And this was like a festival of ideas, if you like, the festival of the oppressed. And many new ideas came up, and some of them were a little bit strange or a little bit unusual or might be considered to be silly, which wasn't really very important, because what was necessary was to have a free atmosphere where lots of different ideas could come out, and of course some of them would crash and burn. And here's an example of this. Was a minority thing, probably dozens or maybe a couple of hundred people campaigning for it. Wages for housework. It said, well, year after year, all the studies show that women do the biggest part of the housework, and so the government should pay women for this work. So wages for housework for all women from the government. This was a campaign to... As you can imagine, there was not much chance that the government was going to accept this, so this is what we might call a propaganda demand. That is to say that the idea is to make people think. This was a little controversial, because some people said, "Oh no, if you demand wages for all women for housework from the government, then you are saying that it's fine that men, that women should do the housework instead of sharing the housework within the family. And then other people said yes, and if we want to share the housework within the family, we must make sure that women have equal pay. Because in many, many couples, the man does a lot of overtime at work because he will make more money for overtime at work than the woman will. Another thread within the women's movement was virago. Virago was a very, very simple idea. You remember, so there was an atmosphere where different women could decide to take different sorts of actions and to set up different sorts of activity to push forward the situation of women. And what the people who founded Virago did was very, very simple. They said, well, look at the libraries, look at the bookshops. The vast majority of books are by men. And we think that it's not just that women write less, it's also that when women write things, and even when they're published, they are quickly forgotten because they are not as respected. So what we're going to do is we're going to set up a new publishing house which will only publish books by women. New books, old books, books translated from faraway places, or local books. And that's what they did, and I believe that they still exist, and certainly were quite important for decades. And here are a few of their books, both novels. I think these are mostly novels, but they also very much published, you know, history books and non-fiction books. And indeed, if you went to visit in the 80s, or even later, but especially in the 80s, if you went to visit somebody who was interested in feminism, or was a feminist herself, you would, if they were sort of an intellectual sort with lots of books in the house, you would usually see a whole bookshelf of a couple of hundred books from Virago. So this was an interesting idea. So the idea here is to raise the intellectual profile and to raise the cultural profile of women. The women's movement did get some support from men. Now, they might get support from men inside the trade. They might get some support from men within trade unions, for example. Or just general support from men, from their husbands or brothers or so on. But there was some organised support from men, and this is this was sometimes organised around the men's groups who produced this magazine, Achilles' Heel. Now, perhaps you remember the myth that the heel of Achilles was the weak part, because when he'd been dipped into the river something to strengthen him, the god who was dipping him had held him by the heel, and so the heel was his weak point. So it's an interesting idea that the magazine is named after a man's weakness. And this was a men's movement, but completely different, or even completely the opposite from the men's movement, or at least men's networks today, which tend to be anti-feminist. Achilles Heel was a pro-feminist men's organisation. And it existed to discuss and understand the role of men in oppressing women, and also to support the women's movement. So some of the local groups would advertise, say, hey, any women's groups, if you need men to look after the children when you have a weekend, we will organise a babysitting or a creche. We will organise a creche. And you can see here that they go into a whole series of quite difficult questions. Yes, so a question on prostitution, use of condoms, black masculinity, serial killers, oh my God. Yeah, and this continued, I don't know how long for, and I've never seen a complete collection, although, you know, if anybody is, there's some research to be done on Achilles' Heel. I think it's a very interesting phenomenon. Of course, this is much smaller. You're talking here about a few hundred men involved in this kind of organisation. Another important strike at Grunwick, led by this lady whose name I have forgotten, but who is quite well known. And Grunwick was a film processing factory at the time. If you wanted to take a photograph, you took a photograph, and then when the film was finished, you took the film to the chemist, and they sent it off to a factory, this factory at Grunwick, to develop your photos, which they then sent back to you by post. It sounds very 20th century. And this strike lasted for many months, and was about being paid less because you were a woman, and was eventually successful, and was important because it was the first immigrant, non-white women strike which received mass support from the trade union movement. And indeed, previous strikes a few years before of black women had been treated rather badly by the trade union movement. So this was an important moment. And going back to the question of the cultural profile of women, one of the activities, as I say, not a monolithic women's movement, but many different activities, one of the spaces where women tried to become present with content about women's rights and about women's position in society was punk rock. And interestingly enough, there was much more space for women in punk rock than there had been in previous genres of rock, like progressive rock or rock and roll. And indeed, if you look at Top of the Pops, which I've done because it's my speciality, the number of women on the programme is far, far higher in the 80s and 90s than it is in the 70s. Rock and roll, rock in general, that is not much, much wider idea, rock in general was very much about men, and indeed the famous people you think of, you know, the Kinks and the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, and we're talking about Led Zeppelin and Queen, and we're talking about men. So here are two examples of punk or post-punk bands which tried to insert something different: the Raincoats and the Slits. And I'll try to remember to put a couple of links on the blog about these people. But there were more as well, but they were very much a minority, of course, but they pushed forward this idea of cultural of elevating the cultural profile of women. 1978, just as the Women's Liberation Front, the organisation, and the Women's Liberation Movement in general, lots of little organisations, had been very much inspired by the black civil rights movement in the United States. That was very key. Influence. Similarly, once white women mostly had been organised in Britain, there was an attempt for non-white women to get organised too. And so the Organisation of Women of African and Asian Descent was set up, and this was the first black women's organisation in Britain to organise at a national level and form an umbrella group for black women's organisations. So that was an important moment. Reclaim the Night, I already mentioned. And then we're going into the 80s. So first of all, I'd just like to say a little word about 1978. I'm pretty sure, if I remember correctly, that the last Women's Liberation National Movement conference was in 1978. And it was very much split. Very much split. And it was that one of the main divisions was between feminists and Marxists. At the time, feminist or radical feminist had a more specific idea, and this was the idea that the division between women and men was the essential motor of society. So if you want to understand why the First World War happened or the Second World War happened, you needed to. It was about men and men's psychology. And on the other hand, the Marxists, whether women or men, said, no, it's the opposite. The centre of society is profit, and women are oppressed because it helps profit happen. That if women do the free work, the unpaid work of bringing up children and looking after their husbands, this will make it much easier for big capital to make money from workers at the workplace. So these two opinions came into conflict, and of course they had very big tactical implications, because on the radical feminist side, one current, probably not a majority, but a very significant current, said we should not ask for support for men, because all men have an interest in things not changing. So we do not need to ask for support for men. In fact, we shouldn't. So what we need to do is to establish you know, women's groups, women's companies, women's shops, and so on. And on the other side, the Marxists or those people close to Marxism said it's only in the unity of men and women that we can actually win anything. And they would look at the Gramsci's Pact and so on. And this, I don't know how much you know about this, and it may seem to you to be a rather obscure reason to divide a movement. In any case, this division destroyed the nationally organised women's movement. Although that was not the end of the story, because a large number of the currents within the women's liberation of the 1970s continued to work locally, or in publishing, or in newspapers, or in television, or in the Labour Party, or in trade unions. Many things happened afterwards, but there was no longer that national organisation, which was certainly a weakness. I think if you don't have a national organisation, you're bound to be weaker. In the 1980s, then, the movement was clearly in decline in numbers, but it did have certain moments of great influence. One of these is Greenham Common, 1982. Greenham Common is a military base where the United States had got permission from Britain to establish new nuclear weapons, new, more dangerous nuclear weapons. I won't go into the detail. And the a group of feminist women decided to establish a peace camp at the gates of this military thing, where they would live all year long and invite people to come and have actions against the base in order to raise consciousness about the danger of nuclear weapons. And it was very much on a feminist basis. So some of the slogans were, "Take the toys from the boys," you know, suggesting that the reason for nuclear weapons is masculine aggressivity, which of course was one opinion available. So these were camps where only women were allowed, and which were very much in the news for quite a while, because they would regularly break into the camp and advertised that they were going to do this and hope, and normally correctly, that the army people would not shoot them, because partly because they were women. Now, this whole movement of different activities and ideas gradually became more respected, and here, this is very recent, this is not from the 70s or 80s, you can see that in a number of universities in Britain, you can take a degree in women's studies. So very, very interesting ideas. This is a master's degree. Yes, this is a master's degree. You can take a master's in women's studies. And this is not unusual. There are quite a number of universities around Britain where you can do this. And this is Oxford University. It obviously has a certain prestige. And so this example, along with the example I gave you of the British Library putting the entire archive of Spare Rib online, are certain signs of the fact that the women's movement convinced a large number of people of the importance of women's liberation. Some people think this, or a sign that the women's liberation movement became less dangerous and became incorporated into elites like the University of Oxford. That's right. A little picture of Margaret Thatcher and all her ministers. And the reason for the picture is that you can see why both feminists and Marxists and other people who were neither feminists or Marxists were not happy with Margaret Thatcher, because although the symbolism of her being the first woman Prime Minister of the United Kingdom was tremendously strong, on the other hand, her determination not to encourage women to have an important place in public space was very harsh and very visible. And as you can see, this picture is extremely impressive. It's not that the majority of her ministers were men; it's that they were all men, which is something absolutely fascinating, perhaps even from a psychological point of view. In later years, there was more space for women in elite positions. This is Stella Remington, who became the head of MI5, the Britain's chief spy, if you like. And in fact, that's where I'm going to stop for today. There's going to be different links on the blog to videos, either videos I've made myself or videos which are available on YouTube, and perhaps other links too. So the whole idea of the semester then has been to take you through some of the big themes, that inclusion and diversity for the last few weeks, and previous to that, the past and the present, to give you some ideas about how to deal with these questions. And we've also dealt with two dossiers and one in your homework, so that's three. In the second semester, my colleague will be looking in more detail at the methodology of how to do the exam, whereas I wanted to start by making sure you knew stuff to say. As you can see, I have got rid of the virtual background, and this is my real home.